Gentlemen, this is Division 7 of the Court of Appeals, and we have one case set for this afternoon. That's the case of Demers against Stepancic. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Counsel are present. They're set up. Thank you very much. You may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Melanie Rowan. I'm admitted pro hoc vice for this case, representing appellant Marilyn Stepancic. This case is about applying the correct Colorado unjust enrichment test to a situation where two parties were engaged in a confidential relationship and entered into a transaction or agreement in the course of being in that confidential relationship, and one party later deviated from their purpose in entering into that agreement. The Colorado Supreme Court has said in the case of Lewis versus Lewis that under situations like that, a particular test, part of the third prong of the basic Colorado unjust enrichment test, applies in order to make sure that the intent of the parties in entering into the transaction or agreement is actually fulfilled.
Ms. Rowan, exactly how did the trial court apply the wrong test?
Here, what the trial court did was look to the totality of the circumstances, and she used that phrase, the totality of the circumstances, in a situation where there had been a number of transactions over the course of years. And the one transaction that's the subject of this appeal, the unjust enrichment claim that is about the $29,000 that Ms. Stepancic contributed towards Ms. Demers' law school education, that one transaction, the district court looked and said, overall, these two parties seem to have come out equally financially. Therefore, I don't find that Ms. Demers was unjustly enriched by receiving that extra $29,000 and becoming debt-free from her law school debts due to Ms. Stepancic's contribution towards her education. But that's not the law here. The law, Lewis says, that you need to look at what happened around that agreement and what their purpose was in entering into that agreement. And the specific agreement here was the contribution that Ms. Stepancic made towards that law school debt. And she made that decision for a particular reason. It was because they were partners. But particularly, she made that decision because, first, in order to sort of enrich their household over time, they both agreed that it would be beneficial for Ms. Demers to go to law school and become an attorney. But more than that, to get Ms. Demers out from under that debt would benefit their household long term, because...
Well, let's focus on that, because I think you just mentioned two potential agreements, and I want to understand exactly what you're talking about. Because there are two time periods here. There's a decision to go to law school, which I gather is made in about 1994, and then there is this decision to pay off law school loans in 2001, 7 years later. So when did the agreement that you're alleging occur, and specifically what was that agreement, and what evidence an agreement as opposed to just an assumption on your client's part?
We're talking about 2001. It's okay. Absolutely right that those are two different questions. The question to support Ms. Demers through law school was part of their relationship. But what we're talking about here was when they chose to refinance the home and put $58,000 of their home equity, $29,000 of which, of course, belonged to Ms. Stepancic, put that towards the law school debt. What was that agreement about? And that agreement was about, and this is in the testimony, Ms. Stepancic testified that what she wanted was to get them out from under that debt. And she perceived it to be, even though we know as a technical matter it was Ms. Demers' debt only, she perceived it to be a shared debt because they shared everything. So they wanted to move that debt into the home because that was a smart financial decision to make, and because she felt that she would be benefiting from the law degree in the long run, so it was only fair to do this. So that was the specific agreement.
I'm not sure I understand. The specific agreement was simply, let's pay off the law school loans because that's better for both of us.
Right.
And that was it. That's the extent of the alleged agreement.
That's the extent of the alleged agreement that was the subject of this unjust enrichment claim.
All right. My confusion stems from your trial brief, in which it is stated that the agreement was that the parties would stay together forever, and that the agreement that was breached was that Ms. Demers decided she didn't want to do that anymore. So, in other words, it sounds like you're saying there's a new agreement here that's not what you were saying below.
In the trial brief, what the parties were talking about was the question of whether it was fair to walk away from the relationship and leave finances as they stood at that moment. I think the correct way to characterize the agreement is not to say that a person never has a choice to leave a relationship and so forth, or that a person has to decide to support somebody else financially for the rest of their lives. But if your intent is that you'll be supporting each other financially for the rest of your lives, and you make decisions on how you allocate your assets and so forth that will save you money under those circumstances, but will not save you money if you're not together anymore, which is the case here, because obviously Ms. Dupancic is still paying the mortgage, but it doesn't benefit her that Ms. Demers is debt-free. It doesn't benefit her that Ms. Demers is an attorney. That's the problem. So that characterization is the one that Ms. Dupancic is arguing for here.
All right. And are you saying that, well, I guess I'm a little confused again. The trial brief says that the court should apply the DCB three-part test. That's your party's trial brief. And now you're saying the trial court erred in doing exactly that. Why isn't that invited error?
The DCB test was the best statement of the Colorado unjust enrichment test that the trial counsel had available to them at the time, because Lewis came out on June 30th, 2008. Under DCB, and what Lewis says, what the Colorado Supreme Court said in Lewis is, looking at our unjust enrichment jurisprudence, it's clear that trial courts have implicitly taken into account these confidential relationships and what was the mutual purpose of the parties in entering into this agreement, and did someone deviate from walking away from that mutual purpose. All of that was implicit in the precedents that were available at that time, and in Saltzman in particular, but DCB, as far as what are the prongs of the Colorado unjust enrichment test, that was the statement of the test at that time.
And you're saying that's not the test anymore?
But that is not the test for this case now, because when Lewis came out, it clarified what the test should be in precisely these factual circumstances, and Lewis should apply for purposes of this court's review.
Well, if that's the case, why didn't you bring it to the trial court's attention that it had applied the wrong test and asked it to apply the correct test? And my second part of my question is, why isn't the test that was applied by the court sufficient even under Lewis?
So to the first part of your question, my understanding is that trial counsel did not become aware of the decision in Lewis until the district court had ruled from the bench. And then, so that would have been needed to be a motion for reconsideration, I think, at that point. But the final order wasn't entered until September. This is a practical explanation to what happened here. The district court's order wasn't actually made final until September, at which point appellate counsel was considering whether to be involved, and we had not made the decision to move forward with this case until after the time to file a motion for reconsideration had passed. So that is the factual explanation for why the Lewis decision wasn't brought to the district court's attention prior to the filing of this appeal.
I'm very interested in the second part of the test, because I don't see anything being mentioned about wrongdoing or anything in the trial court's order. It looks like it applied the third prong of the test, even as in Lewis.
It is certainly not clear from the trial court's order that she did look for malfeasance there. It's not clear. She said, this is the DCB test. The court said, this is the DCB test. I don't find unjust enrichment under these circumstances. So there is certainly no statement that a malfeasance requirement was folded in there. Based on the application of even the general DCB test, though, in light of Lewis, just that general test is not adequate to deal with the factual circumstances that we have here now that Lewis is out there.
Why not?
Because what Lewis says, I'm sorry, excuse me, what Lewis says is that parties who are in confidential relationships can't be expected to have dealt with each other as though they were negotiating at arm's length. They've dropped their guard. They are not functioning as people function in the business context. And because the third prong of the unjust enrichment test creates such difficult questions for trial courts in any event, which is why the Colorado Supreme Court has now twice, once in DCB and once in Lewis, issued particularized third prong analyses, because that's so difficult, once the Colorado Supreme Court has issued guidance on a particular set of factual circumstances, as it did in Lewis, that really is the test for those factual circumstances.
That's fine, but the trial court certainly did not analyze this as if these were people at arm's length. The trial court looked at these people as if they were in a long-term committed relationship, didn't it?
The trial court looked at
the totality of the circumstances. Why is that wrong?
Looking at the totality of the circumstances was wrong because the question, again, is not after 30 years, did they come out more or less financially even? But the question is, when they made decisions, if one of them stuck with what their intentions were in commingling their finances and making decisions such as putting the equity in the home towards the law school loans, one of them stuck with that purpose and those decisions, and one of them walked away and benefited from doing that, by now being debt-free but not needing to contribute back to the relationship in any way. One of them walked away. That deviation from the mutual purpose is the problem.
But Lewis does not say you can't look at any other circumstances besides the one transaction. In fact, in Lewis, it looked at the entire scope of the relationship between the daughter-in-law and the in-laws, didn't it?
I know that Lewis looked at all of the facts surrounding the home and the issue of who would own the home. I don't know whether, the court in Lewis didn't look to whether there had been other transactions between Cassandra and Sammy on the one hand and the parents on the other. And in Saltzman, the court didn't look to what exactly was the breakdown of the expense sharing that that Saltzman and Bachrach engaged in all those years.
Well, if you win and we send it back to the trial court, what do we tell the trial court to do? And what would it do differently, potentially, than what it already did do?
The remedy that we're seeking here is for a remand with a holding that Lewis applies and that there was unjust enrichment here, but with instructions to determine the amount of restitution based on what is fair under the circumstances. So Ms. Demers benefited in the amount of $29,000 of Ms. Zupancic's equity that she contributed towards that debt. And Ms. Zupancic is still paying that to this day because it's in the mortgage. She's paying the mortgage. So the trial court would look to the other circumstances around the issue of who benefited from Ms. Demers' education to determine the amount of restitution.
But even if this were a dissolution action, your client still wouldn't have any claim to the value of the degree.
That's correct. And the value of the degree is certainly not what's an issue here. The question is Ms. Demers benefiting from her debt-free status on the one hand, which cost Ms. Zupancic $29,000, and Ms. Zupancic having lost $29,000 of equity in her home on the other. So the value of the degree itself, and I know that's a very difficult question for courts to answer, the value of the degree is not so much what is an issue. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
I have one question. This gets to the heart of the issue, I think. You allege that there was a mutual purpose, and that's the Lewis test, is whether there is a mutual purpose. What do you do with the trial court's factual finding that there were, quote, no formal agreements or contracts between the parties, end quote? Didn't the court, in effect, find there wasn't a mutual purpose here? There was no understanding as to what they were going to do?
No, I think actually quite the opposite. I think what the trial court was finding there, specifically here, because there had been a written document shortly after the breakup where there were some terms put on paper, and she found that was not an agreement and not a contract. But unjust enrichment is designed to create a bargain where there has been some sort of agreement that was not formally committed to writing for exactly the reasons that confidential relationships should be taken into account, because the parties aren't thinking about it, they're not going to write it down, and so on. So the word agreement here doesn't mean agreement in the contractual sense, but some sort of understanding or bargain that was struck, and the court creates that bargain to fulfill the intent of the parties in the unjust enrichment context.
Are you saying then that this agreement is merely one that's implied, that there was no actual discussion of it, there was nothing expressed, it is simply based upon what the parties should have or did maybe assume about what was happening?
Yes, I'm saying that it's an agreement that would be implied in law because of their mutual intent in doing that. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. If it please the court, I am Diane Demers, registration 28598, a licensed attorney in the state of Colorado, and I appear before you pro se. Abraham Lincoln said that a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. And to that I respond, thank God I'm a woman. But while there's much wisdom in President Lincoln's observation, such as the financial climate that I find myself in today, unfortunately. And as a woman involved in a dissolution of a relationship of 30 years with another woman, I and my former partner and the distinguished attorney here from California have found that the laws in the state of Colorado are inadequate in addressing such a dissolution. And so the defendant then asked Judge Post, in now retired in the district court in Arapahoe County, to apply the principles of equity in multiple unjust enrichment claims. And Zupancic appeals then only the finding against her of one of those nine counterclaims, and that involves this one discrete transaction about law school loans. I am stymied as to where to begin. I will tell the court, and I know that you've read, because I can tell from your case, that you have read what the court has found. And indeed, when the court, in its findings of fact, said that the court finds that there are no formal agreements or contracts between the parties regarding their finances or who owned or was entitled to what. Instead, the parties engaged in day-to-day decision-making as their finances, and they commingled their finances for 30 years. She was making that statement over the general tenure of the relationship. Judge Terry is right. That trial court took a look at all of the testimony, at how we lived our lives, and that trial court then said, there are no agreements. That counsel comes now before you and says, yes, but in the context of this give and take, in the context of a relationship in which one person retired and the other person contributed more to bills, where one person took $55,000 and from a 401k to buy years of retirement from PERA, when that person did that, well, $58,000 for a law school loan that got wrapped up over here, how is that unjust? And although it's not stated in Judge Post's written order, she did say that in her, at the transcript, in the oral findings. You know, Judge Post said, quote, it would be unjust for the court to reallocate what the parties did over 30 years of probably thousands of transactions and decisions by segregating out one decision and saying, well, this decision is unfair. And she went on in her order to say, I can't take a look at one discrete transaction. I can only take a look then at everything in its entirety, because we are dealing in equity. We don't have a dissolution here. That law is not applied. What was argued to the trial court was the Salzman case, and unjust enrichment, because that was the closest thing Colorado had at that time to two people involved in a confidential relationship, two people who were cohabitating. But those people in Salzman had an honest-to-God contract, unlike this, which is one decision in 30 years out of thousands of decisions, and the judge was right.
Mr. Merz, tell me for a moment, tell us what would happen if we were to reverse the decision and send it back to the trial court for additional findings to apply the new case law. What would it look like?
The truth of the matter is, it would look like a mess. Judge Poe's husband died during the course of our trial. And before
recognizing
this,
that,
and she's not even there.
Judge
Post. So she's not even there, right, to say, I'm going to go ahead and apply these factors. So what it would look like is that a judge who had never heard anything about 30 years of transactions and all of the documents and who paid for what, or the fact that I contributed 55% to the relationship and Marilyn contributed 45% over 30 years in terms of our gross amounts, that person would be asked to take a look at one discrete transaction. And that's not what this case was about. This was just a partition. That's what I filed in Arapahoe County Court after a year. Just tell us that we have to sell the house, please. And we got all of these other equity claims in it. That judge is going to have to then hear the entire trial again, I would surmise. Because you can't, as this judge found, Judge Post found, you can't make this one discrete transaction stand apart from everything else. And so we would do the trial again for that person. But I tell you that I believe that nothing changes. You know, in Lewis, the trial court there came up with its own kind of, the trial court in Lewis came came up with its own mishmash of what is unjust enrichment. And in that, that trial court in Lewis said, took a look at the mutual purpose. Oh, it's so that the husband and the wife could live in the house. That's what the trial court said. In the Supreme Court case, after the Court of Appeals reversed and then the Supreme Court came back, the Supreme Court says, well, you know what? The trial court's right. Even though there was no such test at the time of looking at mutual purpose, the findings of fact are sufficient from the trial court to say that that was indeed correct. And the Supreme Court didn't say, go back to the trial court and do it. They just said, we can tell from what the trial court did here that it's correct. You know, there's a case in the Court of Appeals on unjust enrichment, Hahn, H-A-A-N, v. Traylor, T-R-A-Y-L-O-R. It's 79 Pacific 3rd, 114. It was a 2003 decision, and it talks about different parts of unjust enrichment and in a circumstance that really isn't an akin. But the important thing there is that I believe it might have been Judge Daly who said the trial court applied an earlier version of the unjust enrichment test, not even the one that we have currently. But they said we find no error because they found that because we are dealing in equity, they found that in that particular case that there is no error because how the court made its findings, then it satisfied even the current version of the test because of the different findings of fact. I'm going to ask this court to uphold Judge Post, to find that in her findings of fact and conclusion of law, there's certainly substantial findings, even under Lewis, which I don't think even applies here, that even under Lewis, the case comes out the same way. It's simply one person was done, one person was not, and over the course of 30 years, there were so many decisions that to take out one of them would be unjust. I would finally point out, as to your question about invited error and counsel from California's response on that, even if you look at your own notice of appeal that was submitted by Zupancic, the issues to be raised on appeal was that the first one says that the trial court erred by refusing to apply the clear holding of Salzman v. Baccarat. That's the case that got argued before the court all the time. And this is on October the 2nd, I believe, or no, October the 16th, as to when the notice of appeal is filed. Nobody's talking about Lewis, even in October. It's not until this case becomes a cause for the bigger cause of gay rights that we come up with this Lewis decision. You know, maybe Lewis v. Lewis should be applied to gay relationships. Makes some sense to me. It wasn't the law at the time. And even if we applied it in this case, it's not going to change anything. I have nothing further.
Thank you. Counsel, before you begin, your colleague has cited a case to us, Hahn against Traylor, which is not in the briefs. And I'm wondering if you would like an opportunity to, are you familiar with the case? Would you like an opportunity to address that case, either here in argument or separately in a letter to us?
I would be happy to address it in a letter separately to you now. I mean, separately to you after now.
Could you have that to us within a week?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Now, let's make it 3 pages or fewer, please.
And that would be by Wednesday, the 25th. Is that correct?
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to respond to Ms. Demers' point that Lewis does not apply to this case. I think that is the point that she made in her answer brief, and she hit on here briefly that I didn't discuss before, just from a retroactivity analysis perspective, because we did spend some time in the briefs talking about this, I wanted to cover that. It's clear that Lewis should apply to this case based on the retroactivity law in Colorado. The test is that judicial decisions should apply retroactively. There's a presumption in favor of that. And the only time that they don't is if they have overruled past precedent or they were an issue of first impression, neither of which is the case here. And then even if this court were to find that Lewis had been a new rule, the rest of the Chevron analysis that was adopted in Martin Marietta for Colorado, the rest of that test strongly, strongly goes in favor of Lewis applying retroactively here, because it's all about fairness and what is fair to the parties. And the purpose of Lewis is to promote greater fairness by looking more specifically at the intent of the parties and what they meant to do. The only time that you wouldn't apply a case like Lewis retroactively would be if it were to cause inequity because the parties had, for example, relied on a different rule or something of that nature. And that's simply not at issue here. So I wanted to discuss that very briefly and then return to this question of whether we can separate out individual transactions, because
Ms. Rohn, before you leave the Lewis issue, let's assume there's not a retrospectivity problem with applying Lewis in this case. But Lewis, by its terms, applies when there is a, quote, failed gift or contract, end quote. And in that case, the trial court specifically found that there was an agreement regarding the house. But in this case, again, the court found, as a matter of fact, there were no contracts or agreements between the parties. And as your opponent has pointed out, that holding does not appear to be limited to any particular agreement, but the breadth of the language suggests the court was finding that there were no agreements throughout the relationship as to how things should be divided up or how the finances should work. So it doesn't seem to me we even have a failed contract. The court found no contract, as a matter of fact.
I think that the use of the word contract in Lewis really refers to something other than simply a written contract or oral contract, that there is more to that universe of mutual understandings that should be given life through unjust enrichment, that unjust enrichment is there to fill the gaps for people who don't effectively commit their understandings to writing.
And understood that way, this relationship would be filled with many agreements.
That's true.
And many such agreements.
That's true. And it's possible you could conceive of a situation where at the end of a relationship where a home was owned in joint tenancy, that one party would bring a partition action, and then there would be numerous unjust enrichment claims afterwards in which the parties were trying to establish what was fair afterwards. And that would be the law, and it might be burdensome for a trial court, but if there were a number of agreements that one or both parties felt needed to be considered in what was fair financially overall, that would be the law, and that would be what would occur at the trial court level. And here, by looking at the totality of the circumstances, rather than analyzing the unjust enrichment claims in detail, the trial court simply left the parties where they were at the end of the relationship, which is not the purpose of the unjust enrichment law. And in fact, I think it's not Saltzman. I'm very sorry. It might be Wilson versus Prentice. There's clear language that where a district court had said, well, these parties, it was a cohabiting couple, and the district court had said, these parties should just be left where they were at the end of the relationship. We'll leave them where their decisions put them. That is a harsher but similar description of what the district court ended up doing here, which is to say, I can't look at all this give and take. At the end of the day, I can't separate out these transactions. I think it all seems fair. And then unjust enrichment law is designed to go beyond that and actually put some fairness into the process, which is what Ms. Zupancic is seeking here. And my time has lapsed. Sorry.
Thank you very much. That concludes our argument in this case. The court thanks both counsel for their argument. The case will be deemed submitted, and the written opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff may summon out.